He looked at Taverner and myself as if taking our measure, and then lay still, listening to the conversation. I bent over him. "My name is Rhodes," I said, "Dr. Rhodes, and that is Dr. Taverner. Lady Cullen was alarmed at your illness and sent over to the nursing home for us." He looked me straight in the face, and his eyes had a keenness that seemed to go right through me. "It appears to me," he said, "that you are engaged in certifying me as insane." I shrugged my shoulders. "I should need to know a great deal more about a case than I know about you," I replied, "before I should be willing to put my name to a certificate. But do you not deny that you have been called in for the purpose of certifying me?" "No," I said, "I don't see why I should deny it, for it is a fact that we have." "Good God," he exclaimed, "have I not got the right to live my own life in my own way without being certified insane and having my liberty taken from me? What harm have I ever done to anyone? Who has any complaint against me except my brother? And why should I sell my land to pay his debts and turn better men than he out of their holdings? I tell you, I will not sell the land. To me, land is sacred." He stopped abruptly, as if afraid that he had said too much, and eyed me uneasily to see how I had taken this last statement. Then he continued, "If I am deprived of my liberty, I shall not live. I do not want the money. What I have, I give them already, but I will not part with the land. I draw my life from it. Take the land from me, take me from the land, and I tell you that it will not live and neither shall I." He raised his voice in his excitement, and attracted the attention of the group at the other side of the room. The face of the Honorable John was wreathed in a smile of triumphant satisaction at this outburst, and the Countess had again occasion to apply her handkerchief to her eyes and weep crocodile tears into it. Taverner crossed the room and stood before me, looking down at the man on the bed without speaking. Then, raising his voice so that those on the other side of the room might hear, he said, "I have been called in by Lady Cullen, who wanted my advice as to your health, which has been causing her anxiety." The Countess nudged her younger son to induce silence. She was quite satisfied as to her power over Taverner, but the Honorable John, having better brains, was not quite so sure of this man. "I do not consider," continued Taverner, speaking slowly and weighing each word, "that it is wise for you to remain here, and I suggest that you should come to my nursing home, and come now. In fact, I suggest that we should leave the house together." I could see what Taverner's game was. Lady Cullen meant to have her eldest son certified, and his behavior was sufficiently eccentric to make it very likely that she would succeed. If, however, he were at our nursing home, no other medical man would interfere. Taverner and I could use our own discretion whether we certified him or not, and we certainly should not do so unless it were in his interest as well as his family's. It was quite likely that Taverner would be able to put him on his feet and there would be no need to certify him at all. But that would not suit Lady Cullen's book, and if she had the least suspicion that we intended to do other than help her to lock the wretched man up for life, then we also should be discharged as not sufficiently careful. Some man with a licensed mental home would be called in, and Marius, Earl of Cullen, would speedily be under lock and key. It was for this reason that Taverner wanted to take him away then and there. But could he be induced to come? We could not constrain him unless we certified him. Would he, hounded as he had probably been all his life, trust anyone sufficiently to place himself in their hands? Would Taverner's personality sway him, or would he slip through our fingers into hands less clean? I felt as I used to feel in my student days when I saw dogs being taken up to the physiology laboratory. But this man was as intuitive as a dog, and he sensed my feeling. He looked at me, and a faint smile curled his lips. Then he looked at Taverner. "How do I know I can trust you?" he asked. "You have got to trust somebody," said Taverner. "Look here, my dear fellow, you are in an uncommonly tight corner." "I know it very well," said Lord Cullen, "but I am not sure I should not be in an even tighter corner if I trusted you." It was a difficult situation. The poor chap was practically a prisoner in the hands of the most unpleasant and unscrupulous family, and unless we could protect him, he would be a prisoner in good earnest behind asylum bars. And whatever he was now, he would be most indubitably mad after a short course of asylum conditions. He was probably quite right when he said that he would die if deprived of his liberty, for he was of a type that easily become tubercular. Yet how were we to get him to trust us so that we could protect him? Taverner joined me at the bedside, our two broad backs. We are both burly individuals, completely blocking out the rest of the party. He looked steadily at the man on the bed for a moment, then he said in a low voice, as if uttering a password, "I am a friend of your people." The dark eyes took on again their curious filmy look. "What are my people like?" "They are very beautiful," replied Taverner. A snigger from the other end of the room showed how the rest of the family summed up the situation, but to my mind came the words of a seer, "How beautiful are they, the lordly ones, in the hills, in the hollow hills." "How do you know about my people?" said the man on the bed. "Should I not know my own kind?" said Taverner. I looked at him in amazement. I knew he never lied to a patient, yet what had he cultured, urbane, eminent, in common with the wretched man lying on the bed, an outcast, for all his rank? And then I thought of the solitariness and secrecy of Taverner's soul. None knew him, not even I who worked with him day and night. And I remembered also the sympathy he had with the abnormal, the subhuman, and the pariah. Whatever mask he might elect to wear before his fellow men, there was some trait in Taverner's nature that gave him the right of way across the threshold into that strange hinterland of existence where dwell the lunatic and the genius, the former in its slums, and the latter in its palaces. Taverner raised his voice. "I have been called in," he said, "by Lady Cullen, who desired my advice as to your health, which had been causing her anxiety. I am of the opinion that you are of an unusual heredity, and this has made it difficult for you to adapt yourself to human society." I saw that Taverner was picking his words carefully, and that they meant one thing to the man on the bed, and another to the Countess and her other son. "I am also of the opinion," Taverner went on, "that I could help you to make that adaptation because I understand your heredity." "In what way does his heredity differ from mine?" demanded the Honorable John, looking puzzled and suspicious. "In every way," said Taverner. A peal of elfin laughter from the bed showed that at least one person knew what Taverner meant. Taverner turned his back on the others and spoke to the man on the bed. "Will you come with me?" he said. "Certainly," replied Lord Cullen, "but I should like to put some clothes on first." At which hint we withdrew. We seated ourselves in the broad window seat of the oriel at the end of the passage, whence we could watch the door of Lord Cullen's room and so prevent our patient from giving us the slip. My medical training would have told me not to leave him alone at all, but apparently Taverner was quite certain he would not cut his throat, and the rest of the family did not care if he did. We had hardly seated ourselves before the Honorable John returned again to the question of the certification of his brother. "I wish you would let us have that certificate now, Doctor," he said. "There are a number of matters in connection with the estate that urgently need attention." Taverner shook his head. "Things cannot be done in this hasty fashion," he replied. "I must have your brother under my observation for a time before I can say whether he should be certified or not." The three of them gazed at him, speechless with horror. This was an unexpected turn for affairs to take. The certification of a well-to-do eccentric is painfully easy if he remains in the bosom of his family, but it would be impossible to snaffle Marius out from under Taverner's nose if he once went to the nursing home. He might remain there indefinitely, still retaining control of his affairs, effectually preventing his family from laying their hands on the cash, and he even might, awful thought, recover. The Honorable John's mind worked more quickly than his mother's. She still seemed to have some vague idea that Taverner was safely in love with her. He saw plainly that they had been had, and that Taverner not only had no intention of being their tool, but was prepared to stand by the unfortunate wretch against whom they were scheming, and see fair play. He lost no time in acting on his convictions. "Well, Doctor," he said with the bullying insolence that lies so near the polished surface of men of this type, "we have heard your opinion, and we don't think very much of it, and should certainly not be guided by it. I told you all along Mother, that we ought to have a first-class opinion on Marius and not depend on these local practitioners. We will not detain you any longer, doctor, and he rose to show that the interview was at an end. But Taverna sat like a hen, smiling sweetly. I have not expressed any opinion about yourself, Mr. Ingalls, which is the only one you are entitled to ask me for, though if I had, I could quite understand your showing me the door in this somewhat brusque fashion. It is Lord Cullen who has done me the honor to place himself in my hands, and it is from him, and from no one else, that I shall take my dismissal, whether as his medical adviser or as a visitor to his house. During the altercation the bedroom door had opened and Lord Cullen came up behind us, moving silently over the thick carpet. He had brushed his rough dark hair straight back from his forehead, revealing the fact that it grew in a peak, and this made him look even more elfin than the tangled black mat had done. Taverna's strictures on his family were evidently much to his taste, and his wide mouth, with its strangely unhuman thin red lips, was curled up on one side and down the other in a smile of puckish merriment. Lobly by the fire, I christened him then, and the name has stuck to him ever since in that queer friendship into which we ultimately drifted. He came up between Taverna and myself as we stood there, and threw his arms across our shoulders in a strange, un-English gesture expressive of affection. It seemed rather as if he took us under his protection than placed himself under ours, and it was in that light that our relationship has always stood, so defenseless on the physical plane, so potent in the realms of the unseen. Did Marius, Earl of Cullen, always show himself to be? Come, he cried. Let us get out of this house of evil, it is full of cruelty. It is a prison. These people are not real, they are unclean masks. There is nothing behind them. When the wind blows through them it sounds like words, but they cannot speak real words, for they are unensouled. Come, let us go away and forget them, for they are only bad dreams. But you, touching Taverna, have a soul, and he, his hand fell upon my shoulder, has also got a soul, though he doesn't know it. But I will give his soul to him, and make him know that it is his own, and then he will live. Even as you and I live. Come, let us go. Let us go. Away he went down the long passage, swinging us with him by the compulsion of his magnetism, chanting unclean, unclean, in that high, thrilling voice of his that seemed to curse the house as he went through it. Three, when we got him into the car, however, the reaction set in, and he was as unnerved as a child that suddenly finds itself alone on a stage before a great audience. Some unknown power had flowed through him a moment before, sweeping us all, friend and foe, along with irresistible force, but now he had lost his grip on it, it had left him, and he was defenseless, horrified at his own temerity, and watching us with furtive, anxious eyes to see what we were going to do to him now that he had betrayed himself by his outburst. I thought that he was physically exhausted by the excitement through which he had passed, and therefore incapable of giving any trouble, but these queer cases in which Taverna specialized were very deceptive as to their physical condition. They had access to unsuspected reserves of strength which enabled them to rise as if from the dead. I am afraid that I was not watching our patient as closely as I should have been, for as the car slowed down to negotiate the park gates, he gave a sudden spring, leapt clean out of the car, and vanished into a thicket. Taverna gave a long whistle. That is awkward, he said, but not altogether to be wondered at. I thought he came a little too quietly to be altogether wholesome. I rose up to jump out of the car and go in pursuit of our fugitive, but Taverna checked me. Let him go if he wants to, he said. We have no power to coerce him, and are more likely to win his confidence by leaving him perfectly free to do as he pleases than by trying to persuade him to do what he has not got a mind to. It will do him no harm to sleep out in the open in this weather, and I have great faith in the power of the dinner gong. Cullen Court is the last place he is likely to make for, and they will be none the wiser as to his disappearance if we do not enlighten them. But here we are at Shottermill. Let us call in and see Parks and hear what he has to say about the case. There are several points I want to clear up. Dr. Parks, the family physician of the Cullens, was one of the best of our local friends. He knew something of Taverner's speculations and was more than half inclined to sympathize, though fear for his practice kept him from identifying himself too openly with us. He was an elderly bachelor, and welcomed us to his frugal lunch of cold mutton and beer. Taverner, who never wasted time in coming to the point if he had anything to say, opened the question of the mental condition of Lord Cullen. It was as we had suspected. For some time past, Parks had stood between him and certification, and was furious when he learned that Lady Cullen had gone behind his back and called in Taverner, but he was also of the opinion that it would do our patient no harm to take to the heather. In fact, it was a thing that he frequently did, even in the winter, when family relations became especially difficult. "You are the one man, Taverner," said a host, "who will be able to do anything in this matter. I have often thought over the case in the light of your theories, and they render explicable what would otherwise simply be a very odd coincidence, and science does not recognize coincidence, but only causation. I brought Marius into the world, and saw him through his measles and whooping cough and all the rest of it, and I dare say I know him as well as anyone does, which is not saying much, and the more I see of him, the less I understand him and the more he fascinates me. It is a queer thing the fascination that lad has for fogies like myself. You would think we were poles asunder and would repel each other, but not a bit of it. To get friendly with Marius is like taking to drink. Once you start, you can't stop." This interested me, for I had an inkling of the same thing. "The first time I saw Lord Cullen," I said, "I was very struck by his likeness to the old parson at Handley Village. Is there any relationship between them?"
"Ah," said the doctor, "the you have put your finger upon a very curious thing. There is absolutely no connection between the two families save that the Cullens are the patrons of the living and inducted the old man into it, and I expect both parties heartily wish they hadn't. Mr. Hewins hates Marius like poison and made a great scandal once by refusing him the sacrament, but what the relationship between them may be on what Taverner would call the inner planes, well, I might hazard a guess. Is there such a thing as being the spiritual grandfather of a person?"
"Generalizations are untrustworthy," said Taverner. "Give me some facts and I will be able to tell you more."
"Facts," said Parks, "there aren't any, save that the lad grows more like a caricature of Hewins year by year, and those who know the old story remark on it,
yes, and make use of it, too. Now there is a farmer over at Kettlebury who won't turn the first furrow of a ploughing unless Marius leads the team."
"Wait a bit," said Taverner. "Begin at the beginning, and tell us the old story."
"The old story," replied Parks, "has nothing whatever to do with the matter, but here it is, for what it is worth. Hewin's wife was a daughter of one of the broom squires. I suppose you know who they are? Men, often of gypsy extraction, who have carved a holding out of the moor and hold it by squatter's right. It is a terribly hard and wild life, and the men are as hard and wild as the moor. As for the women, the less said about them the better. Well, Hewins married this girl for some reason best known to himself, and a more incongruous pair it would have been hard to find. Her great-grandmother, by the way, was one of the last women to be put on trial for witchcraft in England, and they had a daughter called Mary, who took after her mother and belonged to the heather rather than the gleb. Now this unfortunate girl, as ill luck would have it, fell in love with the late Lord Cullen, and he with her. It was all done quite openly, and everyone thought that the engagement would be announced, but apparently family pressure was brought to bear, and the next thing we knew was that he jilted little Mary of the vicarage and was married to the present Lady Cullen, Marius's mother. The disappointment proved too much for Mary, and she went out of her head, had to be removed to an asylum, and died there within the year, and her ravings, well, it didn't do for anyone to hear them. If she had lived in her great-grandmother's time, she would probably have stood her trial for witchcraft too. Of course the whole incident made an unpleasant impression, and is still remembered among the country people hereabouts, though the Cullens' own set have forgotten it, if they ever knew it. One baby is very much like another, and Marius attracted no attention in his infancy,
save for his peculiar name, which his father insisted on giving him, and for no reason assigned, but as he got big enough to show his colouring, it was remarked that although both the old Earl and Lady Cullen were blondes, Marius was as black as a little tinker. He looked most odd and out of place in the nursery at Cullen Court, but you could have seen a dozen of him sprawling outside the broom squire's cottages, and as he got older, that was where he liked to go, and as a matter of fact, that is where he has probably gone at the moment. He never has anything to do with his own class, but he comes and goes about these moor holdings, goes into the kitchens and has a meal or a drink of milk, or sits by the fire for hours together on stormy days, doesn't tip the people, as you would expect, just asks for what he wants, has it, and goes, and they understand his ways. In return he seems to act as a kind of mascot at harvest and ploughing time. From farms miles away he is invited to cut the first swathe at haying or walk in the furrow at seeding. You can form your own theories. I say nothing, save that year by year he gets more like old Hugh Wins, and Hugh Wins won't give him the sacrament. I thought something of that kind must have been at the back of things, said Taverner. What do you propose to do with him, supposing he could be persuaded to let you treat him? Do you think it would be possible to get him normal? Parks inquired. What do you mean by normal? Countered Taverner. Do you mean average or harmonious? But before the discussion could be developed further, a patient called and we took our leave. I am very much afraid, said I, that they will succeed in locking that poor chap up after all if he wanders about the countryside, consorts with gypsies, and bewitches crops. Don't you think we ought to try and get hold of him? I do, said Taverner, but I shall use my own methods, and they will not consist of a glorified rat hunt. There is a queer sort of bond, I said, between Marius and us. Did you notice it? Ah, said Taverner, you felt a bond. Did you? Now that greatly simplifies matters. You evidently have some sort of affinity with these children of Pan. You remember Diana, and the way she took to you. I felt my ears get hot. I had no particular wish to be reminded of that incident. No, said Taverner, perceiving my feeling, that had to be broken up because it would not have worked. Diana would have taken the whole of you and only satisfied a part if you had married her, but Marius, if you make friends with him, will deal with that level of your nature which belongs to his own kingdom and leave the rest free. It seldom works for people of different rays and planes of development to marry each other under our existing marriage laws, but it is an excellent thing to have a diversity of friends because they develop aspects of one's nature that lie dormant, thereby rendering it incomplete. End of this story, and now next. We had not long to wait for the raising of the curtain on the third act. That very evening, as I came out of the gate by the pillar box, I saw the figure of a man standing on the edge of the moor, silhouetted against the sunset glow. I knew I could not be mistaken in the poise of that figure, although I could not see the face. Remembering Taverner's advice, I did not seek to approach him, but stood motionless by the gate, watching. He had evidently been waiting for me, for when he heard the click of the latch, he turned and advanced a few yards. Do you expect me to come onto the cultivated ground to meet you, or will you come onto virginal soil to meet me? He called across the intervening space. I will come onto the moor to meet you, I answered, and stepped off the paved road onto the sandy waste. What is your name? He cried as I approached him. Rhodes, I answered, Eric Rhodes. Ha, said he, I shall call you Giles. He raised his hand to the branch of a birch tree that hung just over our heads, and giving it a shake, brought down a shower of drops, for a storm had just passed. In my own name, he cried, I baptize thee Giles. When I asked Taverner about this incident later, he said that it was the work of the witch grandmother, but gave no further explanation. Well? Said the Earl of Cullen, thrusting his hands into the pockets of his disreputable tweeds and cocking his head on one side. What do you people want with me? I am not quite so mad as I look, you know. I could behave decently if it did not bore me so much. But I have been fool enough to put myself on the wrong side of the lunacy laws, and I am, as you say, in a tight corner. Would you say a man was mad because he would not release his capital in order to pay his brother's debts, with the certain knowledge that the payment of the said debts will be used as a means of obtaining further credit? I shouldn't, personally, I replied. But if a man combines any unusual form of behavior with a tight hand on the family finances, it is quite likely that someone will be found, sooner or later, who can be induced to say so. If at first you don't succeed, try again, seems to be my mother's motto, said Lord Cullen. Now supposing I were to deposit my suitcase at your nursing home, not that I need clean collars or any such frivolities, but just for the look of the thing, would you give me your word of honor that I should be treated as a visitor and not as a patient? You must ask Dr. Taverner that, said I, but if you trust him, I am sure you will not regret it. Lord Cullen considered this for a moment, then nodded and returned with me to the nursing home. Of course I gave him the promise he required, said Taverner when he told me of the subsequent interview. I promised not to treat him, and neither will I, nor must you. Instead, I had given him a patient to handle on his own account. That patient being? Said I. Yourself, said Taverner. I gave a shout of laughter. You're a downy bird? I exclaimed. I really think I am, said Taverner, with a smile that was a little broader than the occasion seemed to warrant. And I also think that I am not the only bird in the wood. There are two others, and I shall kill them both with the same stone. Marius evidently took his duties as my keeper perfectly seriously, and I, as Taverner wished, humored him to the top of his bent. It was Taverner's custom, when he had a critical case, to devote himself to it for a few days and leave me to carry on the routine of the nursing home, but in this case, he himself carried on the routine, and left me to deal with Marius. Presently, however, I began to have a suspicion that Marius was dealing with me. His quick wits and shrewd, subtle brain made him the dominant member of the pair, and I soon realized that he, by means of pure intuition, was a better psychologist than I was or could ever hope to be, with all my training. Gradually he began to join the party in the office, which was against all professional etiquette, and most indiscreet in my opinion. I must confess to a twinge or two of jealousy at first as I heard Taverner asking his counsel and taking his advice with regard to certain cases that had puzzled us. Marius was far nearer to Taverner intellectually than I was. They both came from the same spiritual place in the hinterland of the subconscious. But in the one the scientist, and in the other, the artist, predominated. Taverner had saved his soul by masking it, whereas Marius had very nearly lost his by exposing it to vulgar eyes. As I listened to the talk round the consulting room fire as the autumn evenings closed in, I often used to wonder how many of their spiritual kin were at that moment languishing in jails and madhouses, and why it was that civilization must needs break such men as Marius on its wheel. I also realized why it is that the occultist works hidden under the protection of a fraternity sworn to secrecy, presenting to the world a mask such as Taverner wore, and hiding his real life from all save his brethren. Marius was a weaker man than Taverner, and had gone to the wall, whereas my chief, protected by the order to which he belonged, handling by means of ritual the forces that ripped through Marius and tore him to bits, grew strong on that which consumed the other. Taverner often threw us together in those days of early autumn that were gradually shortening into winter. Marius had a lot of estate business to transact, and it was my task to assist him. In money matters he was a child, and the moment he dealt with a tradesman was right royally swindled, but fortunately for him, the Cullen property was almost wholly inland, and for this he had a perfect genius, and for him land yielded in a peculiar way. The tenants regarded him with a superstitious veneration, and were, in my opinion, more than half scared of him. They were, at any rate, very careful not to cross him, and to my certain knowledge he cast spells upon the fields, the farmer looking on with a sheepish grin, ashamed to admit his superstition, but desperately keen for the magic to be performed. It could not go on forever, though, and the day came when I had to ask Taverner for a few days off in order to attend a medical conference in London. I got them readily enough, Marius, to my relief, agreeing to my departure without any fuss, and away I went, back to the haunts of men.